I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for choosing this KAXE-KBXE conversation. We are member-supported radio, a National Public Radio affiliate in northern Minnesota. We need your support for our radio broadcasts, our online content, and our podcast. Go to KAXE.org, and thanks for listening. Annette Gordon-Reed is an American law professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. She is noted for changing scholarship on Thomas Jefferson regarding his relationship with Sally Hemings and her children. She was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for History and the National Book Award for Nonfiction and 15 other prizes in 2009 for her work on the Hemings family of Monticello. She is with us today on KAXE-KBXE to talk about her new book, A Blend of History and Memoir, on Juneteenth. Professor Gordon-Reed, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's begin with Juneteenth. What it is, what it means to you, kind of the symbolism of this as well.
Well, Juneteenth commemorates the day, June 19th, 1865, when United States Army General Gordon Granger went to Texas to issue General Order Number 3, which says that slavery had ended in Texas. This was, you know, obviously a couple of months after Appomattox. Lee had surrendered in Virginia, and people thought, most people think that that's sort of the end of the Civil War. But the Army of the Trans-Mississippi kept fighting in Texas, and it wasn't until they surrendered in the beginning of June that Granger could go to Galveston and make this pronouncement. And so it has been remembered ever since then as a day of commemoration, a day of celebration to honor the people who first heard that news that they were not going to be treated as legal property anymore. So in Texas, this involves a family day on June 19th with barbecuing, and the traditional drink is red, some sort of red drink, red soda water. I'm told that hibiscus tea was probably before they had soda, what people used. And so it's a day of celebration, a precursor in some sense to the 4th of July.
You know, it's so interesting because there's a lot in what you just said, because a lot of people would never think of Texas as a place where there were plantations and slavery.
Yes, that's not the image of Texas. I talk a little bit about this in the book, that when people think of Texas, they think of cowboys and cattle ranches and gunfighters, that kind of thing. And that's really not all of Texas. It's not even most of Texas. The most populous part of Texas, East Texas, has its share of ranches and cattle and so forth, but it was a plantation society. The people who settled it came from Georgia, Alabama, other places in the Deep South, and brought enslaved people with them to basically create the cotton kingdom right there in East Texas. Cotton and sugarcane were the crops that they grew, and also lumber, because this is East Texas is part of the Big Thicket, which is a gigantic forest. And so you don't think of that. As you said, you think of other images of Texas that take precedence over the notion of it being a plantation society.
You know, history is your business. History is really complex. You write about in this book about there's a tension between having kind of pride where you're from in your homeland and then remembering the difficult things, the oppressive history. When I grew up in Minnesota, you know, I did not learn about the indigenous people here. I lived very close to 5 different reservations with Ojibwe people. I didn't learn about the lynching of men wrongly accused in Duluth in 1920. And I didn't learn about women, that's for sure. Why does this happen? Why are these stories sort of hidden, and how does it affect us?
Well, it affects us because we don't know the real story. And things pop up, and we're surprised about why a given circumstance, you know, thing happened. And if you knew history, if you knew something about how we got here, it might not be so surprising. Certainly, the slave system in Texas, the system of slavery, helped bolster notions of white supremacy and white superiority. It created a racial hierarchy that continued to exist even after slavery was over. And so you had Jim Crow, and then we had the Civil Rights Movement, and it's been a constant struggle against the attitudes and the beliefs that were put in place many, many years ago. It's hard to walk away from a couple of hundred years worth of history, and Texas history doesn't begin just with Texas. The people who settled it had a history before then, and they brought slavery and the same attitude. So we're talking about attitudes and thoughts that are a long time in the making that continue to influence us today. So this is, it puts a context for things, for people to think about why discrimination is a problem, why, as you suggested here, you don't learn about the people who were considered the defeated in society, the people who were considered to be marginalized, and they're kind of left out of the picture.
We're talking today with Annette Gordon-Reed. She has a new book out. It's called On Juneteenth. Let's talk about education. So this book is a little different for you. It's part memoir as well. And you write about being kind of a controversial figure when you were 6 years old. What was happening for you?
Well, I integrated the schools in my town, in my hometown. I was the first Black child to go to a white school in my town. There was one Black school, Booker T. Washington, which went from K through 12. To service the Black community. My mother was a teacher there. But when Texas instituted something called the Freedom of Choice Plan, or my district had this Freedom of Choice Plan, which was really a way of getting around Brown versus Board of Education. This is 10 years after Brown, which white parents were supposed to pick white schools and Black parents were supposed to pick Black schools. My parents decided to do something different, and they picked a white school for me. And that set off a chain of events that were positive and negative as well. And that's the point of that. When I say that I was a controversial figure, obviously there were some whites who were upset about that. And later, when the schools were integrated, when the Freedom of Choice plans were declared unconstitutional and Black kids had to go to white schools, there were some Black people who felt that they had lost something by losing their school. So they weren't too happy with me either. So I was in between these two groups. I mean, of course, there were some people who thought it was positive, but there was a lot of tension about this.
What did your parents, you had older brothers that stayed at Booker T. School, your elders, what did they think of this? Do you remember knowing any of that when you were little?
Well, I knew that my parents, and they communicated to me, and the circumstances communicated to me that I was doing something unusual and that I was doing something that was important in the scheme of things. This was, you know, we're the mid-60s. We're getting the Civil Rights Act. We're getting the Voting Rights Act. A lot of movement on the question of de jure segregation and or against it. And it was a hopeful or sort of an idealistic time. And I think my parents were sort of in the midst of all of that. And I could sense that from them, that it was something that was important. One of my relatives who lived in Houston went out to Sackowitz, which was the big ritzy department store there. And she bought me lots of clothes and everything. So I would be, you know, I mean, I had clothes, but I mean, she really wanted to do it up to make sure that, you know, you look the part. And I was a good student. Things went relatively smoothly, and my teachers were wonderful to me. My first grade teacher, Mrs. Daughtry, you know, couldn't have handled things better. And so I had this tremendous support, but at the same time, I knew that people were watching. Sometimes there would be people who would come to the door of the classroom and stand and look and, you know, confer with one another. And I could tell that they were observing this scene of a Black student in this setting. So I had a sense that this was important and that there were sort of mixed feelings about what was going on.
You mentioned that some people might have thought that something was lost in integration, in you being in a white school. Could you talk more about that?
Well, one of the things that happened, I think people felt that And I'm putting, my parents are no longer living, and I may be putting thoughts into their heads, but I gather their idealism, they and other people thought that it was going to be transformative on all levels, that everything would change. And some things changed, but not everything changed. But one of the things that did happen is that across the South, I'm not just talking about my town, but all across the South, when integration came in some of these towns, Black teachers were removed from the classroom. I mean, white parents did not want Black teachers to be in charge of their children. And so it was integration, but it was integration of the children, not integration of the power structure. My mother remained in the classroom, but other people did not. And she kind of lost the kind of camaraderie that she had with fellow Black teachers, male and female, who were a generation of people who saw themselves as sort of being in a vanguard. They were going out to train Black students for the struggles that they would encounter in life. And she loved all of her students, Black and white, but white students didn't really need that because, you know, the society had been made, you know, was made for them. And so there was no need for any kind of special exhortation about struggle and so forth. I mean, you could do the normal things that teachers try to do with all of your students, but she understood, she and that generation of people saw Black people as being on a journey and facing a lot of hostility and needing to be, to have people shore them up in certain ways. And so that was lost. I mean, the teachers lived in the community. They knew the parents of these kids. They may have socialized with them. They may have been married to them. You know, the school was extended out into the community as a whole. And as much as I liked my teachers and as nice as they were to me, we didn't have that kind of connection. You know, they lived in a different community. My parents did not socialize with them. We were in two different worlds. We were Texans, but we were subdivided, as I say in the book, subdivided by race. There were some things we shared in common and some things that were just within our own community.
Before we go on this idea of Juneteenth, of a kind of a national conversation or making it a national holiday, what do you think it means in right now in the summer of 2021?
Well, what it has meant in the summer of 2021 and what it meant in 2020, when there was sort of a burgeoning, really an explosion of interest in Juneteenth, was, you know, it's a time to reflect upon America's racial predicament. As I said, you know, slavery, you know, we know slavery, you know, created a hierarchy, a racially based hierarchy, and we're still grappling with that. So Juneteenth is a way for us to remember a sort of milestone in the American struggle to create a more perfect union. And you know, certainly not everything was solved on that day, but it was a beginning. And we can measure ourselves today. We think about how much progress we've made, but think about all the things that we have yet to do as we continue on this journey. So it's a day of commemoration, but to me, it's also a day of thinking about the future. What do we do next? How do we go forward?
That's Annette Gordon-Reed. Her new book is out. It's called On Juneteenth. Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.